This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts or redefining what it means to be creative.
I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Mila Kaslansky.
And we're your host for Art Moves. We are delighted to have Brett Littman with us today. Brett Littman is the director of the Isamu Noguchi Foundation and Garden Museum in Long Island City. But there's so much to talk about when we speak about Brett. And Brett, I'm going to give you an opportunity to just tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. I have a little bit of an unusual journey in the art world. I grew up in New York. My father was a photographer, so I grew up around looking at art books and going to art shows. But I went to Stuyvesant High School, so I was a math and science kid. Ended up at UC San Diego to study pre-med. Got to OCHEM, as many people do, and decided I didn't really want to be a doctor.
Right, the organic chemistry piece.
Exactly.
Yes.
And had a phone call with my parents where I said, I think I'm going to be a philosopher and a poet. And I remember my mom was not very happy about that call. But, you know, in the end, it was quite interesting because by studying philosophy and poetry, I did a lot of writing and I came across many interesting ideas. And I never actually pursued an art historical degree. I simply graduated. I made films in Texas for 2 years and then came to New York and ended up working in the nonprofit world. So my trajectory is maybe a little bit unusual, but...
And some of the places in the nonprofit world.
Yeah, I worked in, started at Urban Glass in Brooklyn.
Fabulous place.
Yeah, which I think
yes.
We met way back when in 1996.
Absolutely. We're telling our age, but that's exactly when we met, yes.
You two met.
Yeah.
Is that true? Interesting.
And then I went off to be the co-director of Dieudonné, a papermaking facility in Soho. Then I went... to PS1, MoMA PS1, and I was there for 4 years as the deputy director, and then back to Soho, to the Drawing Center for 11 years, and now back to Long Island City, to the Noguchi Museum, where I've been director for about 2 years.
So we met some time ago. We had a delightful interview in your office, where you were cobbling together an iPhone/recorder thing for some reason. I don't know why. And there was a number of a few different topics that we talked about that still resonates today. And, you know, you were director of the Drawing Center, that you said that was sort of out of sync with contemporary times and there might have been better ways to depict architectural projects. Mm-hmm. I think that's one thing you talked about.
Yeah, I think, Eli, at that time I was maybe working on a show called The Projective Drawing, which was going to, which did happen actually at the Austrian Cultural Forum about 2.5 years ago, and then it ended up being shown again in Paris. And I think what I was really thinking about was a particular architectural historian, Robin Evans, who was thinking about this idea that maybe two-dimensional drawing cannot really explain architecture, the experience of architecture. Mm-hmm. Geometry is just not enough in two dimensions. So the idea of how do we make something present in space? Now, one can draw in three dimensions. One can use all kinds of techniques throughout the history of architectural drawing to render space. But I think his point was that drawing always fails because the idea of space is spatial. You have to walk through something to truly understand it. So he felt that drawing kind of fails as a way to render the world.
And what day was that?
He wrote that book in the 70s.
In the 70s,
yeah.
Because now we have 3D renderings and VR and AR.
Which is beginning already. I mean, you know, AutoCAD was already there. But I think that the issue is it's not about making that space flat and seeing it that way. And even though we can make perspectival drawings, and that's been happening since the Renaissance, I think his idea really was that there was something fundamentally that fails about drawing in relationship to architecture. And so my show really wanted to understand how artists, contemporary artists, architects, even shamans, I had a shaman from the Peruvian Amazon in the show, how they would actually use drawing to project other ideas. In order to understand their drawings, you might have to cite their drawing in culture, in anthropology, in the idea of shapes beyond geometry that the mind can't understand.
Right. That's interesting. So it's not geometry itself that does it. It's also what's it connected to culturally, anthropologically.
Correct.
And socially.
So
interesting.
What I really wanted to understand is how sight is connected to all the senses and how if we can work on that and to maybe think about the experience of looking at drawings from bringing our whole mind and all of our senses together, maybe we would be able to spatialize, in quotes, things in different ways.
So do you think anybody's doing that in some ways? You feel like sort of at least
I think the artists that I chose, I mean, I had 10 in the show in the Austrian Cultural Forum, and another group of artists in the show in France are pointing in that direction. I've made up the term, the projective drawing. He called it the projective cast. So I would say that it's not a group of people that are working in some way towards a goal. But it was something that was speculative and interesting to me.
I'd love to talk to you about curation. You've been involved with some 75 exhibitions and perhaps many more. Mm-hmm. I'd like to understand the whole idea of how you got into curation and what it is in terms of your thinking around it.
Well, I come to curating late in my career. Mm-hmm. I started curating probably really officially when I was at the Drawing Center, when I became director at about the age of 38. So since I didn't have an art history background, you know, I wasn't necessarily asked to curate, although I have been writing since 1996. So I would say that for me, through my art writing, my writing about fashion, about design and architecture and photography and many mm-hmm. other things, and craft, which I wrote a lot about, I learned how to think through things and mm-hmm. I learned how to tell stories. And I was always a writer. I mean, I liked writing. I was a philosophy and poetry major, as I mentioned. So when I started to curate, I think what I'm always interested in, and I take a very different approach than other, maybe more academic curators, I'm interested in what artists would want to see. What can I show them?
What artists would want to see? Yes. What about someone like me who consumes, who wants to experience?
Absolutely. I'm interested in a general audience as well. Mm-hmm. But I think that my sense is mm-hmm. that when, particularly at the Drawing Center, which is where I curated many of my shows, my constituency was artists. That's an mm-hmm. artist-centric organization. Mm-hmm. It was based in Soho, and it has a reputation of doing things first and showing things that no place showed before. So when I would work on a show, like I did an exhibition with Ferran Adrià, the very famous Spanish chef from El Bulli, who was the number one chef for 10 years. I did a show of his visual ideas about food.
Oh, he did a lot of drawings.
Yeah, he made a lot of drawings.
Brothers too, his brother too.
It was a very controversial show in a way. Many artists were saying, why would I want to go see a chef who doesn't really know how to draw very well? And I said, because he's changed the way that we think about food through drawing and through thinking visually. So my concept really was, I wanted to be able to bring things to people that, and to show them things from a different perspective. I did do shows that were more quote unquote art historical. And strangely, at the Drawing Center, I actually did the shows that were dealing with 14th, 15th, 16th century art more than my academic curators, because I was interested in the idea of history also. And how do we see things from other perspectives?
That's a funny comment by artists mm-hmm. about drawing, because Rauschenberg wasn't a terribly good draftsman. That's why he started using print and stuff.
Yeah, well, and at the Drawing Center, Eli, you know, one of the things that I also thought about, it wasn't about skill. I mean, of course, I'm very interested in wonderful drawings and great drawings, but my goal there was not to show great drawings in quotes. Right. My goal was to basically think about how drawing is dynamic in contemporary culture.
I like the idea that you're talking about shaping thinking around this, you know? Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I think that for me, the basis of curating is shaping thinking. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not about just putting something on the wall. I mean, for me, I want you to come to a show and to say, I've never thought about it in this way. Hmm. And that's really my goal. Mm-hmm. So when I make exhibitions, I generally try to use that as the basis for how I'm going to put the show together, what artists I'm going to work with, what kind of work I'm going to show. So I've worked with many, many mm-hmm. famous artists, but I've taken things from them that maybe no one has ever seen.
How do you know if you're successful in that? Meaning, how do you know that, or how do you measure?
Aside from the thing like, you know, press.
Exactly. But I'm talking about, you know, like that, I'm back to that ordinary person mm-hmm. and shaping thinking of that. Yeah, but thank you.
I mean, interestingly today, I mean, I think it's, mm-hmm. you know, curation is a little bit of a lonely pursuit as writing mm-hmm. is a lonely pursuit. I mean, I would say I've written, I don't know, 300 articles and essays and catalog essays. I mean, rarely does anyone ever say like, wow, that was a great essay. I really loved reading it. I mean, when you curate a show, you know, you get reviews.
You get the accolades,
I think
right.
it is actually on Instagram now mm-hmm. today that one can kind of get a sense of how people react mm-hmm. to things. And it's so immediate. Mm-hmm. So I know it's not about just likes. I mean, if I see people post like, wow, I saw this show at the Drawing Center and it really changed my sense of Neo Rauch's work. I never even knew that he made drawings. I mean, that for me is the kind of confirmation that I'm going down the right path. I think in general, the other group of people that I find to be important to validate what I'm doing, again, is artists, because mm-hmm. I feel that I've learned art history through talking to artists. Mm-hmm. I've been very lucky to talk to artists now for 20 plus years in my career and to stand sometimes alongside them while they're making things, which is also very rare.
Right. You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We are delighted to have Brett Littman with us today.
One of the other things I said in our last chat was this idea about going to these artist studio who, you know, make the statement that they're raising the bar and they're doing something unique, and maybe because they either lack the knowledge or appreciation for art history that they're really
Eli, the context of that was that maybe I said I went to some artist studios and they said we're fighting against modernism, or I've invented abstraction. And I thought, really? I mean, you're fighting against modernism, so what is modernism? And they'd give me some kind of hashed over third rate version of it. And I said, it's great to fight against modernism, but you have to understand what modernism is. And
you
then
go.
You have to tell me, you know, something that you're doing that is actually going to do that. Now, by the way, postmodernism has already done that. So, you know, we're now in maybe post-human art, I mean, whatever that might mean.
Yeah,
so,
post.
You know, and then the other thing was that, you know, if you want to say you've invented something, that's great. There are still possibilities to make innovation. But I think that it's you're within a continuum of art history, and you're in a continuum of history in general. So it's good to understand where you fit.
Maybe think about something else about that, which is this idea of, like, it brought this question to mind of what is art of this
time,
21st century, of this time, not just in it. And I was reading a variety of museum definitions. We talked about this before, of what they consider to be contemporary art. And it was contemporary art in our time. And that made me think back to the discussion we had, and I say, right, but that's not raising the bar, and that's not of the time. Just like you couldn't do photography work before the invention of photography. And that led me to this idea is, and a question, is are we on a cusp of a new renaissance? If you look at the confluence of technology, depiction, materials, Vanta Black, all this stuff, coupled with, you know, a generation that are, you know, digital natives, et cetera. So...
Well, on the one side, I mean, I think through the advent of things like microscopes and, of course, our ability to see things in a micro level, we have abstraction, which is maybe the natural outcome of that from a very physical thing and an ability to see things in a way that we were never able to see them before. On the flip side, maybe the new technology, I mean, we still haven't really broken out of the idea of the icon. I mean, we're still making images. We've been making images for 35,000 years since there've been cave paintings. You know, but maybe with the advent of AR and VR, we might be able to experience things differently in our bodies. There may be different ways of seeing things. There's surely a lot of activity around that. I'm not sure that I've seen anything that really pushes me over the edge to say, I want to, you know, just do that. I'm working on a big project for Freeze at Rockefeller Center. I'll curate this big sculpture park. And I'm going to put a virtual reality piece in the middle of the skating rink, a 40-foot tower.
Fabulous.
But I don't have to build it. But you'll be able to put your iPhone, you know, open your iPhone on an app and see this thing that exists, but only exists in the ether.
Wow. Virtual, like you say, completely virtual.
So, you know, it's a totally different way of thinking about sculpture.
Right.
Yes. I'm really intrigued by a lot of what you're saying and not always exposed to this kind of thinking. Mm-hmm. How do you expose this thinking to much younger, diverse, and under-resourced artists coming from those kinds of communities?
Well, I think throughout
how
my
do you
career,
Bridget,
I've always been someone who's interested in mentorship. I've given lots of tours to community groups, to schools, you know, on my off time. I've really tried to make sure that when I speak in public, I try to be as accessible as I can, even if my ideas are esoteric. I mean, in some ways, you know, I mean, but at the end of the day, I mean, even in Noguchi Museum, for instance, we have a project called TAB, which is teens that come to the museum. They work with us for a year. Every year that we have a new group, I meet with them twice. I tell them my story. Last year was the first time that I met with them. And several of the students came up to me afterwards and said, it's really refreshing to hear that you could be a museum director without, you know, going through the traditional path of doing that. And to be frank, I would say 30 years ago, if you met me and you said you'll be a museum director, I'd say no way. I mean, it wasn't even on my radar as something that I could do. So, you know, I would say, Tony, that for me, it's really about, I enjoy that interaction. I think all museum directors, all curators, you know, of course, we have to deal with our VIPs and our boards and all of these other things. But in terms of diverse ideas and diverse people, the beauty of art is that it is, if you can explain it well.
It's transcendent in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and people, I mean, people ask me, what's your favorite part of your job? And I say, giving tours. And they say, really, mm-hmm. why? Mm-hmm. And I said, because basically the thing that I love is when I give a tour and someone comes up to me and says, you know, I never thought of it that way. Mm-hmm. You've told me something that totally changes the way that I think about this. That's what I live for. I mean, that's what I do my job for, really, at the end of the day.
And I can see you're really, really good at that. No. Now, let's talk a bit about the museum. Mm-hmm. What's your vision? What are your plans for it?
Well, the Noguchi Museum is one of the most interesting nonprofits in the world. It is, if you don't mind, I'll just give a brief little history.
Oh, I would love for you to do that.
And also, mm-hmm. I do want to say that we view the Costco as across the street from us, just to be clear, but that's okay.
She's at the record
straight. I'm a mom.
I know, I understand. Noguchi was an artist who was obviously quite well known. He was living in Greenwich Village in the 40s and 50s, but he was buying a lot of his materials. He was working with marble and slate and aluminum out in Long Island City, because as you know, that was an area for light manufacturing and also for materials. Mm-hmm. In 1959, he stumbled across a small studio, which is across the street from museum, which we still own. And he bought that studio and moved in and built an apartment there, which actually still exists mm-hmm. as well. He ended up looking at the building that we're in for about a decade before he was able to put together the money to buy it. And he basically, at that time, I think understood his position in art history. He was a person who collaborated with incredible people. Mm-hmm. His best friend was Buckminster Fuller. He worked with Martha Graham since 1930 doing sets. He was friends with Edward Steichen, the photographer. He had an affair with Frida Kahlo in 1936 mm-hmm. in Mexico City and hung out with Trotsky. He's kind of like Zelig. He just pops up. Mm-hmm. He was the only artist ever to work with Brancusi in a studio in 1927. So Noguchi was someone who was aware of his own legacy. And he was really the first American.
Did he not create it in a lot of ways? I mean,
of course he was great at his own personal mythology. And he was a very active participant in intellectual circles. And his reputation waxed and waned even during his lifetime. But I would say that Noguchi had a real sense that he wanted to collect his work and he wanted to make that gift to the public. So he bought the building in 1972. Later, he added to the building. And in 1984, before he died, he's the first artist ever to open up a museum dedicated to the artist's work in the world.
Right, which is really interesting. You know, one might say arrogant, but it's not.
Yeah, I don't think artists have to think about legacy. Yeah. And, I think that Noguchi in many ways was incredibly entrepreneurial. He understood what the future might look like. And I think that for him, So we own 3,500 of the 5,000 works that Noguchi made. So just give a sense that, we own about 3/5 of his output. Mm-hmm. There are very few artists that wouldn't sell 3/5 of their work in their lifetime.
Right.
He hated selling works to museums because he felt that they just went into a closet and they wouldn't come back out. So for Noguchi, his idea was, I am interested in how sculpture interacts in the environment, in space. So the thing that mm-hmm. you said when you went in, that kind of serene, mindful.
Right.
Beautiful,
crisp and clear.
Exactly.
It felt like a clear energy. I don't know any other way of expressing
that. Well, Noguchi spent many years in Japan studying Japanese gardens and mm-hmm. studying the ideas of kind of Eastern philosophy and understood how to achieve that kind of space. Mm-hmm. He is a genius when it comes to placing things. And I think that he really was only interested in the space between his sculptures. The sculptures are just simply markers for us to perceive ourselves in some way. I mean, I think this is the way that he thinks. So the museum is set up and still exists under Noguchi's own layout. When I have to think about what the future looks like, I have to think about Noguchi first and foremost. I'm running now a museum. It's the first time that I've done this. I'm running a museum that is a single artist foundation. So I'm the estate. I'm the foundation.
It's pretty challenging,
and I'm the museum.
Right?
It is.
I find that really challenging, right?
Yeah. But, I've been in a couple of places, like the Drawing Center, where people said, I left PS1, which is a very multi-disciplinary place, pretty free, wild, open place, making a lot of interesting cultural history, to go to the Drawing Center. And people were like, oh, you're just going to focus on drawing. It's going to be terrible. And I was like, you know what? Actually, it's fantastic to have mm-hmm. focus when you can do that. And I said, I've got 5,000 years of image making now that I can work with.
It's probably more. I mean, it's the oldest art form. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, if you want to talk about Lascaux, I mean, or Chauveau, I mean, you might go to all the way back 35,000 years. But the point being that, maybe the limitations are good. The beauty of the Noguchi Museum for me and the beauty of Noguchi is that he's a polymath. He's someone who works in design, mm-hmm. in architecture, in landscape architecture, in art, in theater. He had ideas about the future. Mm-hmm. I mean, so he's a, and also I think his values are incredibly interesting.
Speak about those, please.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this. I mean, I may be running a museum, of course, that has legacy and artworks and we are about the aesthetics, but I actually think that maybe the future of the organization might be about values. The values of Noguchi are that it's mindful.
Love that part.
That it's a museum that is really based on this idea of the harmony between nature and art. It's Noguchi himself is hybrid. I mean, he's Japanese American, born Japanese American at a time.
His mother that was Irish, I believe.
Irish,
I read, yes.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Irish American, but he is an American. Mm-hmm. And, you know, many people, I mean, you can imagine growing up before World War II as Japanese American. He was maligned in Japan when he moved there as a child. And when he came back to the U.S., he was considered Oriental.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We are delighted to have Brett Littman with us today. Integrating technology, I didn't see that, but I wasn't necessarily looking for that. Mm. But how do you see that interplay? And well, I'm asking Brett.
I mean, it's interesting technology in museums because, you know, in some sense you could submit that technology works best in science centers, natural history museum. There's always a challenge in art museum because you don't want to have a mediation between the person and the object. And the feeling is in some ways that by having something like an iPad or a VR, actually I saw this in the Rembrandt exhibit in the stage, like, you know, which are people just, you know, using their iPad instead of looking at the work. But I think there's another dimension to it, which you point to, which is like accessibility. I think, you know, and like the thing about, I think it's important to know, you know, Noguchi's background or why he created the shapes he did or what inspired him. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, this is a real struggle for us. Noguchi didn't want any labels. So when you come into our museum, we have no wall labels. You can pick up a card that has all of the names and some brief descriptions of the work, but we don't provide any mediation. The museum itself for many years did not allow photography. We now allow photography so people can Instagram, but even that creates some problems and issues. We had a show of Akari, the paper lanterns that Noguchi did. And I mean, I had some funny experiences. I walked out. I mean, there are a lot of fashion shoots that were happening there, but of course they were all done not by asking our permission. One day I went out and there was a pregnant woman basically in her panties and bra just dancing in the middle of the cloud of the Akaris.
Oh, now and that's a sight for very sore eyes.
This is great, but maybe you should have asked us first.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, I mean, you know, but it was these kinds of things were happening. So, I mean, for us, I think that technology, we just launched a new website that has 65,000 objects from our archive and also our catalog Resonate. We're doing digital stories. The website is accessible to the blind. And, you know, so we're working on all of these kinds of things. We obviously have many possibilities for access. But unfortunately, I think in the museum, we probably will not be at the cutting edge of technology in the near future, because I think that this is one thing for Noguchi he really stressed was that there should be zero mediation. He wanted people to feel the presence and the physical presence of the work.
Because it has aesthetic purity that you don't want to, it's almost like an energy flow.
Now, you are running a museum, and now we'll get, I guess we're going to segue into some of the harder things, which are the fundraising. Mm-hmm. So how do you approach that? Is there a secret sauce that you don't have to tell?
Well, I mean, interestingly, the Noguchi Museum is very fascinating the way that it's structured because we are essentially own the design business. So we have about a $6 million budget. We have a pretty large endowment that we've been able to grow over the years. We have a lot of earned income coming in from Akari and from the Noguchi table. We work with Vitra and Herman Miller. We also, of course, do fundraising. We've been growing our board and diversifying our board. So currently the museum is at probably a transitional moment. We'll be adding some new buildings. My vision for the museum is I don't think that we need to grow exponentially. I'm not a big fan of exponential growth. I think that we could grow maybe by about 5%, 10% and still deliver what we need to do. I would be interested if we were able to increase our endowment, let's say to $100 million, then maybe we would start giving money away. But the thing that's been so fascinating for me is that I'm running this kind of hybrid nonprofit in which I also am an entrepreneur. And I love it. It's the first time in my career that I've been able to not be embarrassed about saying, I like the idea of being entrepreneurial in the nonprofit world. Mm-hmm. Usually that's a kind of bad thing.
No, but it's such a good thing for your survival and to inspire others that are in the space with you.
Absolutely.
Right, because that's what it takes.
And I've met with now, I would say, 30 artists who are looking at the Noguchi Museum. I mean, famous artists who want to start their own foundations or museums as a model. So we've been talking a lot about what this model looks like and how it can work. And, you know, Noguchi was very clear that, you know, from time to time, if the museum needed to sell a work, we were allowed to do that. That's part of our mission, because he understood that in perpetuity, in order for his legacy to continue, maybe not everyone's going to love Noguchi forever.
Right.
You know,
right.
So it had to be kind of set up that way. I mean, people joke and say like, oh, Brad, someone should give you an honorary PhD in art history. And I say, actually, someone should give me an honorary MBA, because I've been running businesses for 26 yes. years. You know, at the end of the day, the nonprofit world, if I can't make my payroll, if I can't fundraise, you know, put in my 5% that I need for growth, or 10% or 20%, everything stops.
Now, let's talk a little bit about some of the other artists that he celebrated, that the Noguchi Museum has celebrated as well.
So the museum has had a history going all the way back to its founding of showing work by people like Buckminster Fuller or people that were very closely aligned with Noguchi. The decision to move past that boundary has been very interesting. I think that still the idea is that we want these works to be formally related to Noguchi or related to Noguchi ideas, or the work should allow us to understand something about Noguchi deeper. Right now, we're about 3 concentric circles away from Noguchi. We could probably be 6 without too many problems. And I think that the idea of, you know, the Noguchi purists that maybe were more upset, I mean, really upset when we first started showing contemporary art, have kind of eased into this idea that the museum can be a place that can actually look at other artists' work. This is where the values idea comes in, because I think that there are a lot of artists who share Noguchi's values but may not be familiar with his work. I would rather proselytize rather than putting people through the eye of a needle. What I'm saying? I mean, I would rather us be out there and say, you know what? We think you would really be interested in Noguchi if you had the opportunity to come here and look at his work. And we'd be happy to spend the time to teach you, because we're interested in your work.
Right.
I wanted to ask you, because I saw this throughout the website, and you talk so much about honoring diversity and affirming the value of each individual's unique interpretations. Mm-hmm. So because, you know, I think that would be a great place for us to close. Speak about that.
We have a very specific pedagogy about how we want you to kind of experience the work. And I think it is a very personal and subjective way. We're not going to give you any kind of overarching way that you should experience it.
So non-judgmental, right? However I experience it.
Exactly.
Right?
And also our educators ask you a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. So this is not about lecturing to you about one particular way. And I think that that's probably for Noguchi at the end of the day. He said that sculpture should be useful in society. I mean, it's very strange to think about that. Usually we think of sculpture as something that the artist has made and maybe someone, you know, goes to a museum and people can enjoy it, the public. But he actually wanted to be a useful object in our society, because if you think about religious sculptures, the Parthenon, I mean, major sculptures.
Shrines,
this was about community building.
But it also about community building.
It was about community building.
It's the original function of art.
Exactly.
It's just the concept of museum, to a certain extent, is the self-selecting audiences. Because I know a lot of kids in certain neighborhoods, teenagers would never consider it. Mm-hmm. Not because it's boring or anything, just because it's not for me. So, I think one of the greatest challenges, not just you, but all museums, is how do you reach this audience? How do you get them inspired? I think art and those things has great value for them. But, I guess it has to be made more accessible somehow. And I guess you have to reach them where they are.
I'm so glad someone like you, with the values that you have, with the clarity of perspective that you have, with the excitement and passion that you have, is running this marvelous institution. And we're just looking forward to more from you. Meaning you've just inspired me as I'm sitting here to just think differently.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
I appreciate it. It's a great place to go to work every day, and I'm really honored to be the director of that institution. So.
And we were honored to have you.
Well, thank you.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.
This has been Art Moves with your hosts, Tony Williams and Eli Kozlansky. Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.